This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, March the 1st, the Chicken Pox for the Soul edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm an editor at Slate, and I'm the father of Eliza, who is 7, and Leo, who is 3.5.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and editor based in Oakland, California, but today recording from Brooklyn, New York. And I'm the father of Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 14.
And I'm Allison Benedict, filling in for Rebecca, also an editor at Slate, and I'm the mom of Harry, who is 9, Sam, 7, and Wally, 5 on Sunday.
Today, in an almost unprecedented development on this podcast, the three hosts are all in the same room. You can judge for yourself whether that makes the show better or worse. We've got questions from listeners.
More awkward.
Will it be more or less awkward? You be the judge. We've got questions from a listener whose kid goes to preschool with some anti-vax families who covet her daughter's chickenpox. And another whose husband has a quick temper with the kids, and she's not sure how to talk to him about that. Plus, as always, we'll have our triumphs, we'll have our fails, we'll recommend things to you. And on Slate Plus, we'll be talking about how we've discussed the fallout from the Parkland shooting with our kids. First up, triumphs and fails. Carvel, welcome to New York. Has it been a triumph or a fail week?
It's been something of a fail week because the fact that I'm in New York means that our kids had to get to school on their own this week, which is not something they've done a whole lot. So the arrangement ended up working but Joe walks to her job. She lives within walking distance of her job, which is why she's never going to leave that job. And she gets to walk around the lake. And then Georgia, she can take Bart to her school, and then Ezra can walk to his school. His school's like maybe a half an hour walk. He walks home, but walking in the morning is a big deal because it takes him forever to get ready. So so this week on Monday I came here on Sunday night. So Monday I didn't pick them up. Georgia and Joe decided they were going to take Bart together, and then that was how they were going to get to school. And then Joe was going to Bart back and go to work, and then Ezra was going to walk. And then he really screwed up the walking in the morning. He was late to leave the house, and everyone was late because they were trying to get Ezra, and he finally got it together and they walked, but everyone was late to everything. So it was a fail. But Joe didn't call me on that day. She didn't bring it up. She just was like, okay, this is what it is.
Well, what could you have done?
What could I have done? Exactly. Yeah. Tuesday morning, I am going to a work meeting, but I have to finish edits for something before the meeting, and the time is compressed. And I get this phone call. I have 15 minutes to like finish these edits, get in the cab, and get to Midtown for this thing. And I get this phone call, and she's like, "You have to talk to your son because he's saying he's not ready for school. We can't wait for him. Georgia can't be late again. He's going to go in his. He's saying he's not going to go, or he doesn't want to go, but he's got to go." And I'm just like, I can't deal with this right now. Like, I'm literally in the middle of a thing. So I finished my edits, and then on the cab on the way to the meeting, I called him and I said, "What is going on?" And he does the same thing he always does when I say, "What is going on?" Which is like, "What do you mean, Dad? Nothing's going on." And I'm like, "No, what? Your mother already briefed me on this situation, so we don't have to go through this whole thing. Like, what is going on?" And he just said, I just needed more sleep, and I slept in and everything. And, I was like, I mean, in the conversation, I was more harsh with him than I usually am. I just said, "You have to get to school on time. There are no exceptions to that. That's not a negotiable thing. That's not based on how you feel. It's not based on how sleepy you are. That is not how that works. You need to get to school on time." And then I said, "You have to handle this on your own. Otherwise, your mother and I will handle it for you. And I don't think you want that." And that was like such an intense line that I
you don't know what it means.
No idea what it meant. No idea what it meant. But he seemed to know what it meant. He said, you know, this is one of the great rules of writing horror is that you let the audience fill in you know, the blanks with their most terrifying thing. And so I said, otherwise your mother and I will handle it for you. I said this from a cab in New York. I felt like I was in a Disney movie, you know, like the busy dad who doesn't have time for his kids. And and he said, okay, Dad, okay, I'll do it. I'm sorry. And then I said it again because it was such a powerful line.
How did it work the second time?
Second time he was like, okay, Dad. Okay. He was like, okay, Dad, I get it. You used a good line. You got it. And, you know, that was the end of that. And then later I texted him. And then at the end I also said, you know, I switched up the tone. I was like, and I'm in New York. And because last year we came to New York together because I had to come here for work, but it happened to be the same day as his birthday. And I have this rule that I'm never going to be somewhere else on his birthday. So I actually brought him with me to New York for his 14th birthday. And he got to spend the day here and he loved it and all this stuff. And I said, yeah, I'm in New York. I'm like in the same neighborhood we stayed in. I wish you were with me. And I said, we'll get together a trip this summer. And I miss you and I love you and all that. And it was kind of like we ended on that note. So I don't know if it was a triumph or a fail. It felt like a fail because I wasn't there and he didn't get to school on time. And it's just like, it's just freaking work-life balance, man. It's just really hard.
That line is a triumph, though.
Yeah, I view this as a triumph.
It's a dramatic triumph. Yeah. It's not a parenting triumph.
Yeah.
Allison, how about you? What do you got?
I have a triumph, too, because I'm going to characterize yours as a triumph.
Okay.
So it's a little heartbreaking, but I still think it's a triumph. I got home from work the other day. This was a couple of weeks ago. I got home from work and Sam, who's in first grade, was sitting on the stool in our kitchen. He was like so excited to see me. Usually the kids when I get home are downstairs in the basement watching a show after dinner. But he was waiting for me. He said, Mom, we got an assignment at school to write an essay about someone and we're supposed to work on it together. And I want to start right now. And I was like, okay, great. And he was deciding between he wanted to write it either about Harriet Tubman or Fetty Wap. And we talked a little about that. I thought, like, he had a book that was like, who is Harriet Tubman? So I thought that might make it a little easier. So he went with Harriet Tubman. And I said, let me see, where's the assignment so we can figure out, like, what does it mean we're supposed to do it together? Because Gabe was in my ear, in my brain, yeah, after having scolded me for putting wheels on the car last time.
If you want to hear that segment, join Slate Plus. Yeah.
And he said, well, she didn't give us, she's going to send a note home on, you know, next, she's going to send a note home, I think this was on a Friday, and she's going to send a note home on Monday, but we can start now if we want. Mm-hmm. So I figured, okay, we don't know what the parameters of this project is, but he's so excited. The last thing I want to do when I, like, walk in the door is immediately start an essay project.
Right, right.
But okay,
welcome
we'll
to
do
parenting.
It. Yes. Yeah. So we sit down on the couch, and he decides the way he wants to do it is that he'll read a couple pages of the book. Then we'll talk about what the important parts are, and then we'll write it out. But he was really objecting to writing it out. He thought he should read the book, and he should decide what the important parts are, and then I type it out.
Uh-huh.
Gabe is really mad. So I said, I don't know if that's really what the assignment is, and we sort of had a little bit of tension over it. And I said, how about this? We'll do that for now, and then when we get the assignment, we might have to go back, you know, back and change how we're doing this. But for right now, we can do it this way this weekend. So we spent like a ton of time on this over the weekend. He was so into it. Every free moment, he wanted to do it. We went to like a coffee shop together with our book and our laptop
cute.
It.
Yeah.
We got to like 3,000 words. I was like, this can't be the assignment. Whatever we're doing is not the assignment. But okay, like he's loving it. And then on Sunday, I took him to this rock climbing gym because he really loves to do the indoor rock climbing walls, and we did it together, and it was like this bonding experience, and we get in the car to go home, and I'm so sore and so tired, and he says, Mom, I just have to tell you something. There's no assignment. I made up the essay assignment, and I said, why would you do that? And he said, well, I just wanted to spend time with you. And
oh,
I'm curious to see what you guys think, but I think my normal Allison reaction would have been to be like really pissed off. Like,
right.
I was already really sore because indoor rock climbing is so hard. Have you
right.
done this?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
so
yeah,
hard.
Yeah.
So I was really sore. I had been like nursing his dad back from the surgery. I just felt very overwhelmed at that
right.
moment. And he lied. And like, we had spent all weekend on this Harriet Tubman essay. But for some reason, I like heard him. I heard the part of what he said that was, I just wanted to spend time with you. And I said that I wished I said, I wish you hadn't had to make something up in order to, like, felt like you had to make something up in order to spend time with me. But I've loved doing this project with you. So if you want to keep doing it, we can keep doing it. And I thought you guys are looking at me like that was not a triumph.
No,
you
no,
gotten
no.
in trouble for lying.
No.
Okay.
No.
I felt like that was a triumph. And, like, although he shouldn't have lied.
Yeah.
Obviously he was trying to tell me something, which I feel, you know, not great about. And
that is such
so we're still writing it. It's really long. And now I'm glad we don't have to turn it in because now it's just like straight plagiarism.
That's fascinating on so many levels. I think one of them is like, what would you have done if he had just said, Mom, I want to spend time with you. Can we spend the whole weekend researching Harriet Tubman?
I mean, I wouldn't have done it, probably.
Yeah.
The truth is.
I mean, that's the thing. Because that I feel the same way. Like, I
you have two other kids.
Yeah.
And a life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, that's something to keep to take into account. I mean, another thing is that one of the parenting maxims that I heard from something or some book or some said, look past the behavior to the need, right? That's kind of a general rule. Like,
yeah.
When kids misbehave, you look past the behavior to the need. And so here you had an opportunity to do that. The third thing it reminds me of is that when Georgia was in third grade, they did these historical figure projects where everyone made their little three, like, cardboard thing about the figure, historical facts, and there was a day when everyone dressed up as their figures, and you go, the adults come, and they ask everyone in the cafeteria, who are you? So, I'm Sonia Sotomayor. Who are you? I'm Abraham Lincoln. Georgia, Gloria Estefan. For reasons that we never understood. She just discovered Gloria Estefan one day and was like, this is the person. So here's like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Here's Harriet Tubman. Here's like all these people from history. And then here's Georgia being like, Gloria Estefan actually is really cool. You know, and like.
Significant for her contribution to the Miami Sound Machine.
I thought it was absolutely amazing. And my favorite is she had this thing that she created that said, true or false, Gloria Estefan was born in the U.S. or whatever it was. And then you flipped it over and it just said, yes. It's one of my favorite pieces of child
You should post
ever.
A picture if you
I
have
a picture
of that
have,
on the
I have
Facebook
to dig it up.
Page.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I will. I will.
All right, nice. Your turn, Gabe.
All right. So I have a fail. I'm happy to report because people get mad when we do three triumphs in
no,
a row.
You never do three triumphs.
I mean, we've done it and we'll do it again. Let's not make false promises. But today I'm happy to report that I have a fail, and it's even a fail of some emotional significance. So the bonus for listeners. So Eliza has been having some sort of anxiety stuff, especially around bedtime. And we've talked about this, Allison, with your kids having similar stuff. But in her case, it's become less about, I think, actually like feeling a sense of fear and more about like she needs to know where we are. And her bedroom's on the bottom floor and the kitchen dining room's on the upper floor of our apartment. And so we put her to bed and then like typically then we go upstairs and have dinner and watch TV or do whatever we're doing. And she started to not like that and she started asking us to like stay downstairs, like stay on this floor with me. And so we would stay there for 10 minutes while she fell asleep. But then, of course, then like you start creeping up the stairs and she like busts you going upstairs to have dinner. Like you can't bust me for that. That's a legitimate human activity. But, you know, after a while, we wind up with our routines kind of being controlled by the compulsions of a slightly anxious 7-year-old. And so my wife and I, we talked about what we should do about it. And we talked to a counselor at the school and we read a book about it and we had a whole plan. And like the whole thing is that like we're going to tell her, okay, now we're going to stay down here for 10 minutes and then we're going upstairs and we'll be right upstairs. And if you need to, then you can come and check on us upstairs, but see if you cannot do that. And if you don't, then you get a sticker. And like, we're not being a hard ass about it, but we're also not letting her like run the show because that's not good for anybody. And like, part of what she wants is like, she wants to know that like there's rules, people are in charge, everything moves along in a like structured, organized way. Right. And we're right there upstairs rather than like right at her beck and call downstairs. In any case, so then the other night, like my wife was out and was doing stuff, and so I did bedtime by myself, and we had such a nice bedtime, and like I read to one, and I read to the other, and I was feeling really warmly about them, and then she said, "Will you stay downstairs?" And in my warm feelings of like being the protective dad who just read these nice stories and tucked the kids in bed, all of the plans and conversations and the meeting with the counselor and the book we read, all of it just gone from my mind. And I'm like, yeah, sure, I'll stay right down there. And I'm feeling so good about this. Like I'm making a sacrifice because I'm quite hungry. I would like to go.
That increases the moral
right
of
exactly,
the thing.
Right, exactly. And then I came up with, like, then I went in and I told her, you know, she's still awake. She's reading. She's like, stays awake and reading until like 10:30 or something. It's ridiculous. But so I go in and I say, okay, I'm going to go upstairs and make myself a peanut butter sandwich, and then I'll come right back downstairs. Mm. And, like, there's some part of me that obviously is very fulfilled by, like, doing exactly what she says she wants.
Yeah.
And then, you know, my wife comes home, and there I am with, like, the peanut butter, the plate with, like, the crust and bread and the empty glass with milk streaks on it. And she's like, what is going on here? And I have, like, whatever. You got to be able to make a plan and stick to the plan. And I failed to stick to the plan. Mm. I don't think it'll be a long-term failure, and we're back on the plan, but that was my failure.
Yeah. I mean, you did the best you could. I mean, like, we get swept up in the feeling of, like, being the great parent, and sometimes we're more interested in that than we are in anything else.
That's right. It's the, like, narcissistic identification with the idea of the dad than the actual, like, what is actually the right thing to do.
It's,
like,
it's funny how that's fleeting, though, because there are some nights, I'm sure, where you...
Ah, fuck it. I'm going upstairs. Yeah, absolutely.
I also just really vacillate between those two extremes. Yeah.
Right, between narcissistically indulgent and, like, totally selfish.
Yeah.
That's great parenting right there.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, before we move on, we're going to do the business. If you have a question that you would like us to answer, you can leave us a message at 424-255-7833, or you can email us at momanddad@slate.com. I have an important announcement, which is that our Facebook presence is moving. If you have not already joined at our new address, it's facebook.com/groups/slateparenting, or you can just search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. It's a great community. It's already, there's a lot more going on there than just mom and dad are fighting stuff. There's all the rest of the great Slate Parenting content, including the advice column that Carvel writes with Nicole Cliff called Care and Feeding. Lots of good conversations happening there. Check it out. Search for Slate Parenting on Facebook. Want to let you know about another great Slate podcast, The Gist, our daily news and opinion show. Every weekday afternoon, Mike Pesca sorts through the torrents of information in the news cycle, selects a few stories that cry out for a closer look because of an odd fact, an untested argument, or a thesis he wants to explore. Think of it as a curated audio op-ed page, but funnier. You can find it every weekday evening, wherever you get your podcasts. That's The Gist. On Slate Plus today, we're going to be talking about the Parkland shooting and how we've discussed it with our kids and whether you should bring your kids to an anti-gun violence march. To hear that segment and to get this podcast and all your other Slate podcasts with no ads, sign up for Slate Plus. It's a great way to help support this show. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing Mom and Dad Are Fighting and your other favorite shows. And in return, you get extended ad-free versions of this and other great Slate shows. So if you would like to support Mom and Dad Are Fighting, go to slate.com/MomAndDadPlus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, let's go. We've got a question from a listener named Micah.
Hello, my name is Micah. My son is 2¾ years old. He attends a local daycare and he has all of his vaccines. Not everyone who goes to his daycare have all of their vaccines. And it just so happens he has come down with chickenpox, even though he's been vaccinated for that. And we got asked by the leader of the school that he come to school sick to, with permission of some of the other parents, to allow them to be exposed to the chickenpox, which I understand because it was like that when I was younger before we had access to the vaccine. But now my partner and I are not so sure. Like, are we supporting a larger anti-vax thing, or are we just helping these kiddos to get less sick than they would if they get exposed at a later date? All right, curious to hear what you have to say. Thanks.
We're both pointing at Allison.
Because I was nodding during that whole, nodding in disappointment during that whole question. Except that the end of your question actually makes me rethink my gut reaction.
Yeah. So no, gut reaction. Stick with the gut reaction. No,
don't stick with the gut reaction.
My gut reaction is that, you know, kind of screw these people who aren't vaccinating their kids. Kind of screw your preschool for asking this of you. Also, I think for letting these kids in. But that's a different, maybe a different, I'm not sure.
You can have opt out. I mean, different states. I know California has like an opt out clause at certain preschools that are not public, et cetera, et cetera.
Get a preschool where there isn't an active community of anti-vax.
I feel that way too. However, you are in the preschool that you're in right now and you're asking about this specific situation. And it is true that it would not, if it would not hurt your child and it would help these kids in the specific, then I guess to make it like to... It's weighing whether to take a stand, like the moral stand against anti-vaxxers, or to help these kids who could get very, very sick later on. I guess I think you should do it. I'm surprised to come around to that final position.
You're saying she should send her kid with chickenpox to the preschool specifically in order to infect other uninfected children because their parents refuse to vaccinate them and think that it's better for them to catch chickenpox.
Well,
right
if
now.
It is true that it is much more dangerous for them to get chickenpox later than it is for them to get chickenpox now.
But let's stipulate
which is
that
the
it,
premise of the
yeah. Let's stipulate yeah. that it is, but yeah. also that there's not no risk of for the kids to get chickenpox now. Like, what if she sends the kid to school and another kid
and
gets chickenpox
like really
and someone
and
gets very yeah? What if there's serious
fault.
Consequences?
I guess
yeah, but that's not her. She's not. I mean, so okay. So I sort of. I mean, this is a ridiculous question because it's a ridiculous scenario. Like, everything about this scenario is just cockamamie. However, assuming that this is all happening, it seems to me that like that. That within those boundaries, like, I mean, this preschool sounds a little whacked out because the idea that, like, can you please come with your child and infect these other children? I mean, shouldn't that happen in a context that is, like, limited? Shouldn't that, I mean, why bring a child to school and have infect everyone who just happens to be there? I mean, I know that the vaccine is, I mean, we didn't have the vaccine when I was growing up, so I got chickenpox in ninth grade, and it did suck. And I was way late to get it, and I really wish I hadn't gotten. I wish I had gotten it earlier, but I think that the logic here is that you're going to only infect the kids that are uninfected, and it will get it off the plate for them. The question is, like, by not doing that, do you take some kind of meaningful stance against anti-vaxxers? And I don't think that you do in this case. I don't think that's a meaningful stance. There are a lot of good stands to take against anti-vaxxing. I don't know that this particular scenario constitutes one of them. And for the kids, the actual unvaxxed kids, it's better who didn't, by the way, choose to be unvaxxed kids. That was something that got foisted upon them. It's better for them to be infected earlier than later. So I think if I was in this situation, as weird and creepy as this whole scenario is, I would probably be willing to let my kid be a vector for this thing. Maybe not in the preschool setting. Maybe like, hey, let's go into a room somewhere else.
Or even call the pediatrician can infect everyone. And ask them what the right thing to do
right.
here
the
is.
The pediatrician
actually.
Is going to tell you the right thing is not to send your kid to infect other kids with chickenpox. That's not medicine. That's like some bullshit folk anti-vax bullshit. This is not. I'm not claiming that this is a meaningful stance. Like, am I going to bring down the whole anti-vax bullshit movement by me saying this on a podcast? My guess is probably not. On the other hand, like, you don't participate in this craziness. Just like there's these people who have this ridiculous anti-science viewpoint that is killing children and bringing back measles, and don't like go along with it. Don't.
But that's that's the principle, right?
Yeah,
and we're saying,
and Carvel was
saying,
like,
outweigh the.
Yeah.
And you're right. That I think the first thing you said is true, that you should, or whoever right, said right, it, right. you actually should call a pediatrician, your pediatrician
yeah.
and ask them about this.
We
if this
have said
is
that.
Total,
we
yeah, I don't
and
know why.
Call and watch yeah. them
don't
tell you
us.
Not to do it.
And then don't do it. But sure. if for some reason Gabe's wrong, Gabe who is also not a medical professional, then I don't know if you need to stand on principle.
I mean, this doesn't sound like a principle. I mean, like I don't it's I mean that would be a resentment. That's a principle of resentment.
Yes.
That's a principle of just like I just fucking hate you, so I'm not doing anything that you want. Ever. And
no,
which to me feels a little, it's like.
Do what they want on some other issue. Like if that parent then also wants you to bring like chips for the potluck, bring the chips for the potluck. But don't do anything that they want that furthers their bizarre and messed up and destructive agenda.
Okay, but you don't. And then what happens? Are they going to then vaccinate their kids because you didn't? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's not, this is not, I'm not making a consequentialist argument here. I'm not saying the outcome is necessarily better. I'm saying there's some things that I just don't right. want to participate in, and this is definitely one of them.
So a lot of my belief here is based on what may be just bullshit science, which is that it is better. I'm thinking about the kids who did not choose to be anti-vaxxers. So yeah. screw the parents. The kids are in this situation. These preschoolers have been thrust into this world.
Yeah.
And so my assumption is that it is better for the kids to get to contract chickenpox early. Earlier rather than later. And if that's the case, then I would think I'd like to do what's better for the kids, even if their parents are anti-vaxxers.
Well.
I'm with Carvel.
This is where you balance your resentment against the parents against your resentment toward the parents against what's helping the kids who are innocent victims.
All right. The one consequentialist argument that I will try to spin out is that if you facilitate the weird folk medicine of the anti-vax community,
yes.
then you're encouraging
yes.
this sort of methodology. And the way this stuff spreads is through people like posting about how I sent my kid to preschool and they deliberately got chickenpox from some other kid. And now my kid is very healthy and you don't need vaccines. And by participating in that, by allowing them to do that, yes, you are, for the purposes of argument, you're helping out these kids medically, we're assuming, but you're also helping out this ideology,
right.
not medically, but like socially and by lending your support
sure.
to it.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't have been opposed to this in the, like there used to be chickenpox parties, right? Like people used to do this.
Like before the development
before
of the vaccine.
Vaccine.
Yeah, if it was the medically right thing to do, then sure.
Because this isn't about, the reason why is because this isn't about chickenpox. It's about vaccines as a whole.
Right. It's about ideology and it's about vaccines.
Right.
It's a tough one.
I don't think
it's
that tough.
It's also such a fucked up scenario. It's
yes.
just like, it feels like something from a poorly scripted movie. I can't. It's the whole thing's screwed up.
If you're a pediatrician listening and you think Gabe is completely right or work, whatever, like
definitely
go to our
call.
Page. Yeah,
let us know how right I am. Facebook.com/groups/SlateParenting. All right. Thanks a lot for the question. Let us know what you decided to do.
Talking about money can be so hard, especially when the person you're talking to is still learning how to do long division. That's why Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace, is here to help. I'm Bridget, and with my fellow co-host Ryan, we help teach your little ones about complex topics like bankruptcy, climate change, and why there's so much gold at Fort Knox, and so much more. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.
Time to take another question. This one is from Ellen. It came to us via email. It's being read for us by Browbeat assistant Rachel Withers.
Is it okay to contradict my husband when he's disciplining the kids? My husband and I have two boys, ages 4 and 7. Due to a bunch of circumstances, including work stress and poor sleep, my husband's on a short fuse. He has little patience for kids just being kids, making lots of noise, wrestling, running around the house, etc. He's quick to snap, quick to yell, quick to punish. Although sometimes it's warranted, most of the time I think he's being an unfair jackass. If I send him private, turn it down looks, it just makes him more mad, but now at me too. How can I spare my kids from undeserved punishment? Can I defend them when my husband's in the middle of disciplining them? Is there a way to calm everyone down in the heat of the moment? Thanks for your input, Ellen.
Yeah, in general, situations where emotions run high, it's hard to address them in the moment. This is a conversation that you have to have because this is a problem, I think. And this is a conversation that you have to have with your husband separate from the moment at which he's most agitated. I it's, you know, without knowing what is or isn't too much, because, you know, this is, happens a lot with letters. Someone's like, someone is doing such a thing too much, but we don't know how much over too much it is. But I do feel like if you're, as a parent, if you find yourself losing your temper on a consistent basis, that's a problem that needs to be addressed on principle, because good parenting doesn't come from that. And kids really suffer under impatient parents. Now, we all get impatient. Lord knows I get impatient. My kids know I get impatient. But it's something that I never feel like is right or appropriate or acceptable. It just happens sometimes. And then when it does happen, I'm like, look, I lost my temper back then. I'm really sorry about that. And I really work not to do that. You know, and like, I think that that's like a really important part of parenting. So kids being kids should not make you angry. And if you feel anger at that, you have to pause when agitated before you unload that on your kids, and most assuredly not on your partner, because it's not, that's like, you know, that's just creating more issues. So that's all a way of saying this isn't acceptable. But I think the way to talk about it is not in the moment. I think the way to talk about it is to make a longer term argument. Like, look, this behavior is damaging to the kids, and here are some other things that we should do. And I think that if the, like, so to get into like logistical stuff, if the problem is that dad is working and then dad is like irritated because he's exhausted or whatever, and the kids are running around the house, I think that there needs to be some way of addressing that logistical problem. So maybe like dad is in the bedroom for some period of time, or dad, or this other thing. But I think telling the kids to be quiet because dad is around is not good. And I think dad snapping at the kids is really, really not good. So that's pretty much all I have on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you just said. We certainly have struggled with this, both right. in terms of losing our tempers and also sort of the, I feel like John and I are never on the same, like either he's more stressed right. and more difficult, and I'm in taking that out a bit on the kids, and I'm in like a much more chill mode and like sort of wished he would tone it down, or it's the flip. We're never right. like both up here or both down here. And I used to do actually a lot of like sort of trying to confront him in front of them or tone things down in front of him, and it was not ideal for yeah. anybody. I think particularly if your husband, when he is calm and when you are away from the kids, recognizes this, you're in a much better spot, because then yeah. then you can come up with the strategies that like Carvel is talking about. If he doesn't see this as a problem, that's a bigger problem.
Yeah.
But if he's, I wish I hadn't gotten so heated back then, right. I wish I hadn't lost my temper, the kids are just driving me crazy because of this, this, and this. Sure. Then you guys actually can work together. And if it means in the moment, I think that your kids get an unfair punishment, like you just have to let that go and deal with it later. Like, I mean, yeah. as long as the punishment is not, you know, something horrific. But if yeah. your kids get sent to their room for something that you think they shouldn't have gotten sent to their room for, so that you can later deal with it, I think yeah. that's okay on occasion. Your kids will survive that yeah. experience.
Yeah.
Well, so I also agree that the best situation here is if you can talk to your husband separately and figure out a strategy with him that will help him in the moment, or help get him out of the situation, or whatever's the best way to deal with that. But the questioner really specifically asks, can I defend them when my husband is in the middle of disciplining them? Is there a way to calm everyone down in the heat of the moment? I don't think you can. Can
you?
Can't,
right?
When a person
I
is
mean,
no.
unless he's like, unless he's going to be physically abusive,
right.
or
yeah.
really like
yeah.
sort of it crossing a line.
It never works to intervene for what you've got this weird triangulation that happens.
Yeah.
You've got the interaction between the parent and the child, which is one thing that's happening.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work to add another
right,
dynamic where the parent
and
in
the
that
kids
moment.
See it.
And the
right.
kids
they
see that.
And
they,
right.
yeah.
When you've got an angry person, especially I think an angry man, and you come in and like, undercut that anger and tell him that his anger in this moment is not justified and is harmful, it doesn't usually calm him down.
Even if you do, I mean, I tried several times. I'm making my husband out to be a monster, and I don't mean that, but we had sort of gone through this sort of stressful period of time where I feel like I was in the role of like trying to yeah. step in a little bit more than was great. And I tried a couple of times sort of being like, not saying you're doing the wrong thing or not trying, but just saying like, hey, like tap out, like go, like
yes.
I'll handle this.
And that hasn't
and you
worked either.
Go just chill out or go
yes.
for a run or whatever. And when you're pissed off, you don't want that either, actually. Like you think you can handle it. You're not, you know.
Yeah, like, you're on sort of a high of
yeah,
anger.
Yeah.
yeah.
I can vouch for that. And I would say that both Joe and I have gone through different periods of levels of patience. But I know definitely the, hey, looks like you're stressed. Maybe I could step in here.
Yeah.
Right.
Joe has never been like, wow, thank you so much. It's like, you saying I can't do this? Is that what you're saying? You know, you're just like, everyone's like, yo. And so everyone's gotten a lot better over the years as our kids have gotten. That was definitely more when they were toddlers and there was a lot. Now everyone's gotten really a lot better. And, but I, you know, I just, it's taken me years to learn that there really is no proper place for the expressions of anger in parenting. Because I wasn't raised that way. I was raised that, like, the parents say, I'm mad, and then they let you know. They demonstrate that they're mad. They don't just communicate it. They demonstrate it. They yell. They throw things. And that's how you remain in line, because you don't want to make parents angry. And so I thought that was normal stuff. And so, but when I had kids of my own, it didn't feel 100% correct when I did dabble in that. That just felt like, well, that doesn't seem right, but I guess that's what you're supposed to do.
Like, I'm so much bigger than that.
Right.
How is this okay?
And I think a big breaking moment actually was with my dad, who, you know, I grew up with corporal punishment, and my dad, who is now in his 70s, one day we were talking when my kids were little, he said, you know, when we were growing up, it was different. He said, you don't have to hit kids. And like I knew that already, but hearing my dad say that somehow, it was like he acknowledged that there had been a change in the way things meant. And it wasn't resentful, and it wasn't like these, like, you know, snowflakes nowadays can't discipline their kids. He directly recognized that, like, that he was raised in the context in which the parents around him felt like that was all they had and that there were good reasons for doing that way. He carried some of that forward into me and my brother's childhood, not all of it, but pieces of it. But that, fortunately, that no longer, none of that needs to be carried forward. And I really appreciated that, hearing that. Because before I felt like I was like an outlier, you know, that every time my kids were out of hand, my family would be like, well, what do you need? Just a smack upside the head. And I'd, you know, and it's sort of like, I felt like I wasn't holding up my end of the bargain as a parent. And that was annoying. That's a frustrating place to be. But I wasn't going to do that. So it was like a relief to hear my dad go, actually, that's not, we don't need that, you know?
Do you also feel, I mean, I guess, Gabe, your kids are young like mine, but do you feel like you have managed your anger better as your kids got older because you've come to like these realizations, or in part because it's just like it's a different sort of dynamic, like the kids are just less in need of that sort of?
It's hard to tell. I will say that both of my kids have said one particular thing to me at one point in their lives that has changed everything. And I'm going to give you George's right now. At another point, I'll give you Ezra's, but I'm going to give you George's right now. I think I might have told the story before, but I had picked them up. This is after we were separated. We were doing a week on, week off. So I picked them up at school on Friday. They'd be in my car and we'd be driving. So for a week, I hadn't really been around elementary school kids. Not really. I think we had dinner like once. You know, we'd have dinner on Wednesdays, but it wasn't like around them. So Friday, I go to pick them up and my week has been quiet. And then all of a sudden, the kids come in the car and they're loud. And it's like a Friday and they're picking them up from third and fifth grade or whatever. And they're just blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah. Yelling and screaming, playing music, whatever. And we'd been in the car 15 minutes, not even close, you know, and I said, guys, can you guys just keep it down? It's like, so, and Georgia said, Dad, if you wanted it to be quiet, don't have kids. And the way she said it, I'll never forget it, because I thought, she's right. She's 100% right. Like, what am I expecting? You know, and that's what I mean when I say you can't get mad at kids for being kids. That's what they do. They behave like kids. And so I think that's helped me a lot to, you know, you have to baseline belief that the anger is never appropriate to express, but whether or not you feel it, that's a longer term process. And I feel it much less, but not, I don't think it's because the kids are better, because teenagers are terrible. God bless them, but they can really push your buttons. But I don't feel that anger much anymore, because there's a much larger sense of the fact that they're just doing their lives as best they know how. And just because it doesn't align with my vision doesn't mean I have the right to sort of flash on them.
Right. I mean, they're terrible in all kinds of ways, but they probably don't like physically jump on you as much.
Right.
They don't do. But the other stuff terrifies you, because fear is the guard dog to anger, as they say. Like, fear is underneath all these emotions, or anger is the guard dog to fear. So underneath all this is fear. Like, for me, and like when my kids misbehave, the anger is really the first level of like a fear that, well, what if they go out into the world and they do this and it hurts them or it hurts other people? And so I would say teenagers bring that a lot more, because with teenagers, they really are in the world. And so every one of their misbehaviors, it feels like the stakes have been raised dramatically.
All right. Thanks for the email, Ellen. And let us know how it goes. Good luck. We're going to do some recommendations. Now, Allison, do you have a thing to recommend?
I do. The Pushcart War, Jane Merrill's 1964 kids book that I had never read growing up, but it is apparently a classic, so I'm guessing that you guys read it or had it read to you.
Never heard of it.
Really? Interesting. I always come to this. I come to these recommendations with a lot of baggage, like growing up in Youngstown and getting like a terrible education and just like assuming that everyone's read everything that I haven't. But I guess even you guys. Okay. Well, it's really good. It's it's told from the future. It's like a historic, not the future, like the future from today, but the future 1964.
From then.
Yeah. A historical, like, journalistic report about a war in New York City 10 years prior. So I guess the war, whatever, 64, mm-hmm. the war happened, was uh-huh. being told in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
Between pushcart peddlers and truck drivers. Truck drivers were trying to push pushcart peddlers off the street, and pushcart peddlers decided to fight back. It's just like there's no one protagonist. It's not like a Harry Potter-esque book at mm-hmm. all. There's no, I mean, there's fantasy in that this never happened, and mm-hmm. it's told as though there was, this is like a real important thing in history that you kids now need to learn about.
Mm-hmm.
The Daffodil Massacre and the, like, it's all these, it's very, but it's just, I don't know, it's just really, my kids were just super into it. It's very engrossing, and I can also, like, I think, you know, there's a political message. I'm not sure the kids really grok to that, but, like, they just got into, like, the characters that are all, like, sort of Harry the Flower Peddler, and the, like, they're all, you know, mm-hmm. and they don't go deep on any of the characters. It's really sort of about the mechanism of this battle. And I think they should update it for today between, like, Uber and, I don't know, bike riders or something. But it's good. The Pushcart War. Highly recommend it for, like, 7 to 10.
Huh.
And you've encountered this in the context of reading it to the kids, or they've read it on their own and
no,
you've looked at it?
No. My sister-in-law bought it for us. I read it to them. And then I started Googling because I liked it so much, and there's been lots written about it. So it's clearly like a very popular classic book that I had never heard of.
Yeah, I feel like I recognize the name vaguely somewhere in the recesses of my mind, but I never like read it or came across it.
Some famous person has been trying to make, Tony Kushner has been trying to make a movie out of it for like many years, and I guess failing.
Wow, so. There's a lot in that sentence.
Yeah.
That I need to process.
You would think he could manage it. Cool. Carvel.
Yeah, I'm recommending two books, and when I explain what they are, you'll know why. I'm recommending The Dangerous Book for Boys and The Daring Book for Girls, which are written by two different sets of authors, but I'm recommending that all kids read both.
Hmm.
And I think it's weird, or if you really want to do it, you could switch. You could switch. You can give the – and so that's what we ended up doing. Like, we had – someone bought – Ezra, The Dangerous Book for Boys, when he was like 6, and then somehow we acquired The Daring Book for Girls a few years later. But then they both went into the general collection, and both kids would look at both. And for those who don't know, it's I think probably the nearest analogy is an almanac, right? It's like it's a bunch of information. It's not a story. Some of it is historical stories. Some of it is stories of past war. Some of it is how to tie a knot. Some of it is like how to like fold a paper into a crane so you could pass a note in class. And some of these are gender separated in a way that obviously we don't need to adhere to, but the content in both books is interesting. And I just find that like my kids were really into just opening up any page at any point when they were bored and just reading a page about, you know, the Peloponnesian War and this kind of like, oh, that's about fascinating. So I recommend both books for kids of all genders, The Dangerous Book for Boys and The Daring Book for Girls.
That sounds really good.
Yeah.
I am going to recommend a Marvel Comics series. It's called Squirrel Girl.
Oh, yes.
And Eliza's gotten really into it. I started reading it with her, and now she's reading it on her own. And Leo is just now old enough that I can start reading comic books to him. So I can safely say that it's appealing to anyone from 3 and a half up to age 43. It's a superhero comic about a girl who has the powers of both girl and squirrel. So she can jump very high and climb trees and talk to the squirrels. But she's also a normal college student. It's a Marvel comic, and so it participates in the ordinary sort of premises of superhero comics, but it works by she's always looking to resolve conflicts in a nonviolent way. And so you'll get supervillains like Kraven the Hunter, like a classic Marvel bad guy who's fought Spider-Man in the Fantastic Four a million times, and it's to do with like who can punch him harder. And she's the first superhero to ask, well, what does Craven the Hunter actually want?
Yes.
What drives him?
To look past the behavior to the need.
Yeah. Exactly. How can we satisfy? How can we? That's right. Look at that. We come full circle. Nice work.
That's what happens when we're on the same room.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
She says, how can we satisfy his violent urges in a way that's harmless to people, in a way that allows him to sublimate into some socially productive behavior? She doesn't use that language because this is a comic book. But each of the stories then resolves in a sort of surprising and heartwarming and happy way. And I think it provides a good model for kids of how to think about conflict in the world. And it's also super funny and like genuinely funny, not just like dumb puns in the standard comic book way funny. So collected in paperbacks. You can find them in bookstores everywhere. Squirrel Girl from Marvel Comics.
Yay, these are all really good.
Love it.
Like, I'm going to go get all of those.
Yeah.
And that is our show for today. It's been fun having you guys in the same room. This has
been
really,
really cool.
Yeah.
If you have a question that you want us to address, you can call us at 424-255-7833. You can let us know what you thought of the show on our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/SlateParenting. This episode was produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Allison Benedict and Carvel Wallace, I'm Gabriel Roth. We'll be back next week.